President Biden wraps up his trip to Eastern Europe.
It was really a sight to be seen. There were hundreds of people lined up, and then when we got there, it was fully packed.
Plus, are China and Russia growing closer?
Wang said that Sino-Russo relations have withstood the tests of the international situation and remain mature, tenacious, and stable.
And later in the program, we meet a Ukrainian refugee who settled in Portland, Oregon.
She became a refugee last February, waking her daughter Paulina to the explosions of the Russian invasion.
Today is Wednesday, February 22nd. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint, Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Lori London. President Joe Biden is wrapping up his four-day visit to Poland and Ukraine and continuing to reassure Eastern Flank NATO allies that his administration is keenly attuned to the looming threats and other impacts of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I spoke to VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wuticuswara in Warsaw, traveling with the president. Patsy, the president, along with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, attended a summit today with the so-called Bucharest Nine countries on the alliance's the most eastern flank countries. Can you tell us a little bit about how that went? And I know that there were a lot of anxieties about Putin potentially making a move to take military action against them if he's successful in Ukraine.
Well, certainly this is a grouping that is most anxious about what is happening in Ukraine right now. This is a grouping that, you know, not many people outside of Europe know. It's an initiative launched in 2015 by Romanian President Klaus Iohannis and Polish President Andrzej Duda, essentially to enhance cooperation amongst NATO's newest members in support of the alliance's goals to improve security and stability in that, you know, kind of eastern flank region between the Baltic and the Black Seas. So they just met, actually they're meeting right now, and President Biden is reaffirming U.S. commitment for benign security. These are, of course, all the members who were previously under Moscow's sphere of influence during the Cold War, but are now looking at Moscow's expansionist ambitions with concern. And so President Biden said today that Washington's sacred commitment to defend NATO's Article 5 of collective defense is sacred. He's saying that this is the nations are the front lines of our collective defense, and you know better than anyone else what is at stake in this conflict. And that's a message that's also repeated by Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, who said that 1 year since the invasion, Russian President Vladimir Putin is showing no signs of stopping. He is not preparing for peace. He's preparing for more war. So we must step up our support for Ukraine. So there's a general anxiety among B9's members, even though there's a different level of support for Ukraine among the members. One notable absent leader is Hungary's Viktor Orban, the prime minister, who sent his president instead, more a ceremonial position there, because as we know, Hungary is landlocked and is very much dependent on Moscow for oil and gas. So Orban has made a couple of declarations in support of Moscow, saying that the war in Ukraine is not a conflict between the armies of good and evil, but between two Slavic countries that are fighting against each other, and that is their war, not ours. So there's some differences of opinions and levels of support, but broadly speaking, there's going to be unity expected coming out of this summit in preparation for the NATO summit in Vilnius in July.
And of course, yesterday, President Biden came out really strong in a speech from Warsaw. Can you tell us a bit briefly about how that was received on the ground, and as well as also how White House officials are feeling about the whole trip?
We had a chat with several members of the National Security Council team last night, and it seems like they are feeling good about what happened in the past 2 days. They were able to pull off the Kyiv trip, which was, of course, under secrecy. It was a surprise visit. But generally, they felt like it was the right thing to do. They were happy that they were able to pull it off. And they also pushed back against Russian claims, particularly the one made by former President Medvedev, who said that, you know, Biden is going to Kyiv because Russia has given security guarantees. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told me that that's not the case. Now, as for the speech itself, it was really a sight to be seen. There were hundreds of people lined up. And then when we got there, it was fully packed. It was outdoors. Thousands of crowds. I mean, by the Warsaw mayor's office, it was 30,000 people.
That's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wittakuswara in Warsaw.
Poland has been at the center of the Ukrainian refugee crisis. We'll get an update from there next. Now, Russia and China showcase their deepening ties Wednesday in a series of meetings in Moscow, closely watched for signs that Beijing might offer stronger support to the Kremlin for its military operation in Ukraine. More from VOA's Steve Miller.
Wang Yi, the Chinese Communist Party's most senior foreign policy official, met with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday during his visit to Moscow. Calling the current situation grim and complex, Wang said that Sino-Russo relations have withstood the tests of the international situation and remain mature, tenacious, and stable. Relations between Russia and the West are at their lowest point since the Cold War, and ties between China and the United States are also under serious strain. Moscow suspended its participation in the last remaining nuclear arms control treaty with Washington this week, and the U.S. expressed concern in recent days that China could provide arms and ammunition to Russia. China has pointedly refused to criticize the invasion of Ukraine, and Russia, in turn, has staunchly supported China amid tensions with the U.S. over Taiwan. Steve Miller, VOA News.
For the past year, Poland has led the refugee response as millions of Ukrainians fled the Russian invasion. Meanwhile, Poles are having to adjust to the large-scale land warfare taking place on their doorstep. As Henry Ridgewell reports from the border, that conflict spilled over into Poland late last year.
Pszewodów is still in mourning for its two lost sons. The small village on the Poland-Ukraine border was thrust into the center of global attention when, on November 15th, a missile exploded on this farm, killing two local workers. All that remains is a large crater. NATO and Western allies said the explosion was likely caused by a stray Ukrainian air defense missile. But at first, many feared it was a Russian attack. For a few terrifying hours after the missile exploded, the world believed that Russia's war on Ukraine had come to Europe, to NATO territory. And as the conflict escalates, the communities here continue to live in the shadow of war. The leader of the local council, Grzegorz Drewnik, says there have been many fearful moments over the past 12 months. The worst were the first days of the war, when the front was moving here to the west, and nobody really knew at what point it would stop. Nobody knew whether we would be bordering the Russian Federation in any moment. Over this last year, a lot has changed. Lots of grief, sadness, anger. Well, later on, I guess it's human nature that you get used to everything, Drewnik said. The communities along the border were the first to witness the fallout of Russia's invasion a year ago. Friends Natalia Kostikiewicz-Kolasinska and Renata Zhua live in Tomaszow-Lubelski, a few kilometers from the border. Very quickly, people started coming in, Renata said, and here our whole community mobilized, and people rushed to help the Ukrainians who were streaming into our town in big numbers. Our family, who live further away from the border, called us very scared, Natalia said. They asked us if we had passports, if we were going to escape in some way. It didn't occur to us at all because we were so involved. Like thousands of other Poles, Natalia took in a Ukrainian family, seven people in total. She says she has bad days where she fears the war is coming closer. Some of the conversations we have are about what our plan B is, she said. We have in the back of our minds all the time that something is going on. When I wake up in the night, you can hear the warplanes. You can hear them really circling overhead. It's hard not to think about the war. Thousands of refugees still travel across the border from Ukraine. In the opposite direction, Poland is the key conduit for Western weapons being sent to aid Ukrainian forces. For the people here, war doesn't seem far away. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Pshevadov on the Poland-Ukraine border.
An American congressman visited Kyiv on Tuesday. We'll find out what happened in a few minutes. First, though, 1 year after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, refugees fleeing the violence have settled around the world. For VOA, Deborah Bloom takes us to meet a refugee mother and daughter in the U.S. Pacific Northwest state of Oregon.
At a Ukrainian fundraiser in Portland, Ina Kovtun is doing what she does best, performing. Before the war, Kovtun was a fixture in the Ukrainian arts community as artistic director of the Rozhenitsa Folk Ensemble. She became a refugee last February, waking her daughter Paulina to the explosions of the Russian invasion.
It was no panic, it was shock. We lived in a 17th floor, it's so high, and when we see our military plane, one, two, and we understood our military fly to protect. I woke up Paulina, and because we decided to leave immediately, 1 minute she was prepared, and I just said, Paulina, this is war.
Like many civilians, Kovtun and her family fled west towards the border with Poland. Her husband Sasha was unable to leave Ukraine because of travel restrictions on military-aged men. But he insisted they go on without him when Paulina became nauseous, unable to eat, and unresponsive to medication.
I didn't want. I asked, please, can we stay here? But because of Paulina, I understand if we stay, it will be so bad and I don't know who can help us.
Ina and Paulina found help in Portland with fellow musician and longtime friend John Durant and his wife April.
Russia started bombing Ukraine. And John and April was and immediately send message, how are you, Ina, and please come here.
As far as we were concerned, they were welcome here as long as they needed to be here, and frankly, I never wished for them to leave. I'm quite happy having them here.
John and April. Also, yeah, this is like our family.
Kovtun is working part-time at a pharmacy to save money for her own apartment. Helping Paulina adjust to life in Oregon, Kovtun is also chipping away at some of the more challenging parts of being a refugee in the United States, including getting health insurance, a social security number, or a credit card.
Hooray!
Separated from her homeland, Kovtun has joined local Ukrainian festivals and fundraisers to keep alive the country's rich folk traditions.
This folklore is a lot of unique song, a lot of unique ritual, and it's so important in this time, not like lost it, and we should share it with our children.
In her new home, Kovtun is looking to keep those traditions vibrant by working towards the creation of Oregon's first Ukrainian cultural center. Deborah Bloom for VOA News, Portland, Oregon.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Lori London. The UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine reports that more than 8,000 civilians have been killed and more than 13,000 injured, including hundreds of children, since Russia invaded Ukraine in February of last year. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN officials say that nearly a year into the war, there's no indication that the ordeal will end soon. They warn that Ukraine's civilian population will likely be forced to endure more suffering and devastation. The head of the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission, Matilda Bogner, says the figures gathered by her team are lower than the actual numbers. This, she says, is due to limited information and lack of access to key areas of Ukraine, such as Mariupol. Despite this, she says, her team continues to gather information from witnesses and survivors.
My colleagues interviewed a former prisoner of war who was from Mariupol, and he was forced in Mariupol to collect bodies on the city's streets. He told us that Russian soldiers were expected to meet a daily quota of one truck of corpses per day, and that, as he said, in Mariupol, meeting the quota was not a problem at all.
Bogner says the UN monitoring mission also has documented a wide range of violations of international human rights law. These include summary executions, torture and ill-treatment, sexual violence, and forced disappearances and arbitrary detention. The report finds that explosive weapons have caused the most casualties in Ukraine and that attacks on critical infrastructure intensified after October 10th. Russian attacks on Ukraine's power infrastructure have left major cities without power or running water. The UN monitoring mission has information regarding 160 civilian casualties, including 30 deaths in the territory of the Russian Federation. Since this information cannot be corroborated, these figures have not been included in the numbers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Michael McCaul, Republican congressman from Texas and chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, led a delegation to Kyiv on Tuesday. Our Anna Chernikova was there.
Steve, so it was quite a packed this last couple of days for Ukrainian capital, for Ukraine, with the visit by President Biden and then the Congressman McCaul and his delegation as well. So he was in Kyiv with four colleagues. What we've heard from him and his colleague that basically their main goal of visiting Ukraine was to see Ukrainian need for military support, what is needed now and immediately, and of course also to see by themselves all the war crimes that have been committed by Russian forces in the Kyiv region. So what he mentioned during the press conference that he himself and the delegation had a meeting with President Zelensky where they discussed particularly Ukraine's needs on the battlefield and also the U.S. weapon monitoring program. This was also, as again, according to him, it was one of the main points for discussion and for the future discussions as well. He said that President Zelensky pointed out once again the crucial need for long-range weapons and aircraft so that Ukraine can protect Ukrainian civilians and civilian society and critical infrastructure from Russian missile and drone attacks. Congressman McCaul expressed the assurance of a positive decision regarding both, so regarding long-range missiles and aircraft. However, he said that the main question that remains is the question of timing, so time length for this decision to be finalized and implemented. And also, Congressman McCaul confirmed that he and his colleagues had a chance to visit Bucha, which is at the outskirts of Kyiv, to witness the evidence of the war crimes, violation of the Geneva Convention, and the atrocities committed by Russian forces. So this is according to Congressman McCaul.
Now, Anna, there are some members of Congressman McCaul's own party that are growing skeptical with increasing aid to Ukraine, increasing financial aid to Ukraine. Did he address that at all?
He didn't particularly talk about this. What he said that he personally supports these supplies and supports the speed up for this supply. So he said that he is not happy with the speed that U.S. government has in terms of agreeing on the supplies and on implementing that. This is particularly what he mentioned during his speech. But again, I should say that he was very enthusiastic in, you know, showing his assurance that all this will be, you know, realized. However, again, he mentioned the time lengths that this remains the main issue for the moment.
I'm sure a big sigh of relief was heard all over Kyiv after he said that.
Yes, for sure. This is something probably that Ukrainian society and Ukraine in general would wish to hear and would wish to be implemented and realized.
We'll leave it there for today. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine began 1 year ago on Friday. In that time, thousands have been killed, millions have been forced to leave their homes, and thousands of prisoners of war continue to be held in both Russia and Ukraine. Achille Dupre, the International Committee of the Red Cross spokesperson in Ukraine, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that from day one, the ICRC has asked Russia and Ukraine to give their workers full access to POWs, and he says they have seen some progress, especially since last December.
We have had renewed visits on both sides, which means that we were able to see more prisoners of war. We were able to bring them some assistance. For example, in some cases, we brought blankets. In some cases, we brought books. So we hope that this renewed access and these new visits in December are going to bring us closer to our goal, which is to have full, unimpeded, and regular access to all the prisoners of war. But sadly, it's fair to say that until this day, our access has been incomplete and only sporadic. So we keep asking the parties to the conflict to fulfill their legal obligations as per the Third Geneva Convention.
Can you get a little more specific when you say sporadic, incomplete, I get, but when you say sporadic, can you elaborate on that?
So we have been able to visit several hundreds of these prisoners of war on both sides, but we know from talking to the families, for example, in Ukraine, we have families contacting us almost every day that they are without news of their loved ones, of a son or a husband who is missing as a result of the conflict. So we know that we're essentially talking about thousands of prisoners and we've only visited hundreds. So that what's makes us say that our access is incomplete. And also one important point for our visits is that they should be also repeated and regular so that we can regularly see these prisoners, check on their detention conditions, check on what they need. It can be something as simple as bringing them a blanket because it's too cold. So these sorts of things. So we need to see them not just once, but repeatedly.
Talk about those conditions. When you do go, what do you see?
So this is not something that we are talking about in the public domain, because this is really a part of our dialogue that we have with both parties to the conflict. We know that if we talk about the internment conditions of prisoners in general, not necessarily only in this conflict, but in general, the risk is that it limits even further our access. That's why we're not talking about these conditions publicly, but we are talking about these conditions with the detaining authorities, with the parties to the conflict. And when we see something that we think should be changed, we, of course, say this to the relevant parties to the conflict.
Sheila, I want to know your feelings. A year ago in February, did you think we would be here talking about this now?
Look, I think it's virtually impossible for anyone to say that they thought that what happened was going to happen. This international armed conflict that is now making so many millions of people suffer was something that personally, and I think the whole international or humanitarian organizations didn't see coming. But the important thing is that once it happened, we rose to the challenge and we stepped up our operations to meet the needs of these people.
Achille Dupre, the International Committee of the Red Cross spokesperson in Ukraine, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media, just follow VOA News.
On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening.
Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.